The Vintage Gamer, Episode 22, Dragon Quest.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. Each time in The Vintage Gamer, I take a look at a game from the past. It could be a board game, card game, role-playing game, or a computer game. You can download this show, and many others like it, at www.thevintagegamer.net. Or, better yet, subscribe via iTunes, our RSS feed. So, welcome to another episode of The Vintage Gamer. This week I'm going to be talking about going for the role-playing game aspect of things with Dragon Quest. Before I get to that, I want to get some news and notes out of the way. First of all, if you haven't noticed, I've revamped the website a little bit. I got tired of the old format, and I wanted to go for more of a three-column format with the standard blog stuff on the right, the standard podcasting stuff on the left, and sort of this middle range of where all the articles actually go. So go check it out. It's sort of a work in progress right now. There are some links that aren't quite working, but everything that was there should still be functional right now. Now, you'll notice that I'm not using my usual setup here. I'm actually recording at work in the sound room, and I'm using a little portable recorder here. We did figure out what was wrong with our regular setup. There's a little switch on our microphone that actually lowers the volume of the microphone by up to 20 decibels, and that was turned on, which leads to us shouting into the microphone to get any sort of production out of it, and producing a lot of hiss as well. So we took care of that problem. So the next time you hear me, I should sound much, much better. I want to throw up a big thanks to Dirk and Aldi of Board Game Speak for playing my promo in their last regular Board Game Speak show, at least the last one that they have played. They might have more coming. I was listening to their tribute show from Beatnik Turtle, and I realized I'd never thank them for that. So just throwing a big thank you out there for them. And speaking of other podcasts, there are some new and some changed podcasts out there I wanted to mention, which are particularly apropos considering this is an RPG podcast. First of all is Domain of Apocalypse, which has changed their format from sort of a standard, well, let's sit around and talk about storytelling and role-playing games format, to actually doing radio play productions of their role-playing sessions, which I think is kind of an interesting approach. So you might want to tune in for that. Sam Chupp of the Bears Grove podcast has started up a new podcast called Square One, which is dedicated towards new role-playing game players. So if you're interested in role-playing games but haven't had a chance to try them out, you might want to check out that podcast there. Or if you're an experienced role-playing gamer and you want to just kibitz, you could check that out as well. And finally, Paul Tevis of Have Games Will Travel fame has started up another podcast with another guy. And this is called The Voice of the Revolution, and this is a podcast about independent role-playing games, sort of the self-publishing arm of the role-playing game industry, so publishing through things like Lulu. I'm a big fan of Paul's Half Game Whistle Travel show, and I'm looking forward to this one as well. Finally, there is a new version of Realpolitik out there, and it's not one that I actually worked on. It's called Real World, and it adds the modern variant stuff to Realpolitik, so it adds airplanes, essentially. I will include a link to that in the show notes and probably put a link to that on the Realpolitik site. For those who didn't tune into the Diplomacy episode, Realpolitik is a diplomacy adjudicator. So if you are a diplomacy fan, please go check this out. I'm really excited by this because it was one of the features I wanted to add and just didn't have any time to do it. So that's about it for news and notes. I'll be back with the actual discussion of Dragon Quest right after this.
Warning, the following information is classified top secret. Well, okay, that's not true, but we think it's cool just to tell you that. The subject of this dossier is Random Signal, a podcast produced from an underground super ultra-mondo secret facility located somewhere in the Durham, North Carolina area of the mid-Atlantic United States. Its host is Jason Adams, codenamed Kryptonaut, called by some as a rebel, a geek, and a spitting image of Jane from Joss Whedon's Firefly. Random Signal is a podcast for the independent musician, offering a platform for music too good for the mainstream music industry. More data can be obtained on the Random Signal at randomsignal.com. It is your mission to fill your podcatching client with many episodes of Random Signal, a podcast that is so totally Airwolf that Ernest Borgnine is starting up a Backstreet Boys tribute band just so he can get an interview on it. Subscribing to Random Signal is your first priority. End of file.
So welcome back. Here talking about Dragon Quest. Now, just to be clear, when I'm talking about Dragon Quest, I mean the paper role-playing game published by Simulations Publications, Inc., not the console or PC, it might be a PC version, role-playing game, nor do I mean the books written by Anne McCaffrey or any derivatives thereof. No, this is a completely independent role-playing game system, very much like D&D. Simulations Publications, Inc. is also known as SPI, and since that's a lot easier to say, that's what I'm going to say for the rest of the show. SPI has somewhat of a checkered history. If you want to get more information about that, I'm going to include a link to an article by Greg Kostikian about that. It was founded in 1977 to publish the magazine Strategy and Tactics, and then it branched out into publishing war games. In 1980, it decided to challenge TSR in the RPG market and came out with this role-playing game called Dragon Quest. It's not their first role-playing related game. They sort of did one with John Carter of Mars, but that was more of a board game with role-playing game elements in it. It was designed and developed by Eric Goldberg, who's also worked on other notable games. Again, I'll include some links to those in the show notes. And it is an early skill-based game. Now, it's not the first skill-based game. I'm not sure which one came first. It might have been RuneQuest. Might have been Traveler. Those came out in 1977. And as I said, this game came out in 1980. However, it's certainly one of the more popular skill-based games out there. It originally came out as a box set with three paper-bound books. If you remember the original D&D box set, it had that kind of flimsy paper book. It had three of those with different sections, the different sections being character generation, magic, and then skills, monsters, and adventure. Along with the three books, it included a hex map, so you could just run through a simple combat on that hex map, and some chits to put on the hex map as well, which included icons for monsters and items and things like that. Now, the game was popular enough to produce a revised edition in 1981. The big difference between the first and second editions is how movement was handled in combat. In the first edition, movement was handled through action points. In the second edition, this was changed to a tactical movement point system, which just controlled basically how far you could go. If you're familiar with D20, it's basically instead of you can move 20 feet, you get 4 TMR points that you can use to move, each TMR point representing 5 feet. The second edition also came in that three-volume box set, but most people for second edition went out and bought a single-volume hardcover book, which had all three bound together, and also included the second edition was a new adventure. Now, as I mentioned, the system was very popular. It was popular enough to win some sort of award. I was not able to track down which award that was, but it does say on the cover, the award-winning fantasy role-playing game system. And as well as this game being popular, SPI was also at the top of their game back in the early 80s. Greg Kostikian in this article estimates that they were the number one war game, that's pure war games as opposed to kind of the family-style war games that Avalon Hill was producing, in 1982. Unfortunately, that game design success didn't really lead to financial management success. They went bankrupt in 1982 and were bought out by TSR. And some say they were actually bought out just so TSR could get Dragon Quest. I can't say. But it is a popular conspiracy out there. And there's a period of time where if you see certain war games published, you'll see them listed as SPI/TSR. What happened, again, according to this article, so this is all from Greg Kostikian's point of view, is that TSR pretty much broke the war game line. Completely screwed it up, and screwed up Strategy and Tactics, which eventually got bought out and published by Decision Games now, and nearly killed the war game industry. And only now is it really coming back with Columbia Games and GMT. And of course, Strategy and Tactics is still popular, at least in the war game community. Now, as far as Dragon Quest, TSR did republish it in a third edition. And what they did is they gave it the same treatment that they gave to D&D 2nd Edition, which is that they took out all the black magic stuff, which scares a certain crowd of people, and added some material from an unpublished fourth book called Arcane Wisdom. Most people don't actually like the 3rd Edition because they did kind of water down the system somewhat. So pretty much the gold standard for Dragon Quest is that 2nd Edition. With some additional changes as well. Now, it looks like that would be it for Dragon Quest. I mean, 3rd edition came out, it's highly unpopular, and no edition has ever been published since. Well, it's not quite the end of it. There at least was a very strong, but small, community supporting Dragon Quest out there. There are a number of Yahoo mailing lists, one of which is called DQ Rules, which talks about rule modifications to Dragon Quest, clarifications, things like that. They also made expansions, adding new skills, new magic, and additional material. As part of that, someone actually got a hold of the prototype version of that fourth book I mentioned, Arcane Wisdom, and has made it available on the internet. And I'll talk a little bit about what was in that book a little bit later. Now, as far as additional rules and sort of clarification to those rules, there seem to be two camps out there. There's one camp that resides in New Zealand, and they have their own rule set, which they use for their particular campaigns. And then there's another camp, which seems to be associated with the mailing list DQ Rules, which I mentioned earlier. And they have what's called, it's kind of an open source Dragon Quest. They've got their revisions there to the base 2nd edition book. I believe they were originally working together, and then there was falling out, and the New Zealand folks just kind of went on their own. Now, my personal history with Dragon Quest actually begins with D&D. We originally started playing that in the late 70s in middle school, which gives you some sense of my age. But we kind of grew dissatisfied with it. We actually found the system a little too simplistic, and we just got bored with it. And so the guy who was our GM at the time went out and bought some books for other systems. We tried out Traveler, which didn't go over terribly well. Either we were just weren't ready for that kind of system, or maybe we just got tired of rolling up characters that died as soon as you rolled them up. We also tried out Villains and Vigilantes, which actually went pretty well, but I think we really wanted to do the fantasy role-playing, so he found Dragon Quest, and we fell in love with that system, and that was our base system through all of high school. And the things that we liked about Dragon Quest is that it corrected some of the problems that we had with D&D. I mean, I always had a problem with armor class and how damage was handled. Like, a negative armor class means that you're more armored, and armor class doesn't actually affect how much damage you take, which in real life, armor absorbs damage. Now, armor class really controls how well you can block, which seems to be more of a shield, sword kind of thing, and evasiveness. And that stuff has been fixed in D20, but back in the day, that just kind of bothered me. So what is the game? It's kind of your standard role-playing game. It's got stats, which are physical strength, mental dexterity, agility, endurance, magical aptitude, and willpower. And you can see some correspondences to the original D&D stats there. Dexterity has basically been broken up into manual dexterity and agility, and they actually have a physical beauty stat, which is optional, which replaces charisma. There are some secondary stats, which are fatigue, perception, and tactical movement rate. Fatigue is replacing your hit points. As you take damage, you'll initially take it out of your fatigue, and then as that goes down to zero, you'll take it out of your endurance, and if your endurance goes down to zero, then you are dead. I believe if your endurance goes down below a certain level, you become unconscious. You can recover your endurance and your fatigue through rest. Fatigue obviously comes back faster, and endurance takes more time. You spend time in a house of healing, and you get your endurance back. I'm not going to go into too much detail about how these stats are generated. You roll dice, you get some points, and then you can throw them into the stats. And the higher you roll, the more points you can spend, but then your maximum is limited. And the stats generally run from 5 to about a max of 25. You have to have a minimum of 5, though. There are races, just like D&D, and races will change your stats, just like in D&D. But unlike D&D, where, you know, race will change a couple stats, in Dragon Quest, the race will actually change almost all your stats, if not all your stats. And you can't actually pick the race outright. You can't say, I want to be a dwarf, and then modify your character that way. You have to roll to see if you can become a dwarf, and you get three chances at it. And this is because some of the races are actually more powerful than other races. So you can be a shape changer, and that is very difficult to get. The chance of getting that is very low. There are some other things that you can roll up your celestial aspect, which controls bonuses that you get at certain times of the day, certain times of the month, things like that. You can roll for birthright and station, which controls how much XP and money you get. So if you're a poor bastard, you are going to get very little money, but you're going to get a lot of experience. Whereas if you're a rich firstborn, you're not going to have a lot of experience, but you're going to have a ton of money to spend. And this is your starting experience, by the way. And then you roll for the money and experience based on your birthright, and you spend that. Get your initial equipment and get some initial skills. The amount of experience you get is not terribly high. I believe the highest number of points you get is 150. And as an example, just to show what that means, a lot of the weapons, like a first rank, will cost you 65 to get the first rank in a weapon. So maybe you can get a rank in a weapon, maybe weapon and shield to start out with. You also, at this point, get to pick a magic college if you want to be a magic user. And these, I mentioned that this game is a skill-based system, so you're going to be spending your experience to build up skills, whether combat skills or just, you know, adventuring skills. Magic is also, you spend points to build up and learn spells. However, there is a class element to it in that you have to choose a college of magic. So an example of a college magic is College of Air Magics, which is sort of an elemental magic system, or College of Sorceries of the Mind, or the College of Black Magics. Yes, that's not in third edition. And these colleges will restrict what spells you can use and what context you can use the spells. And they also have bonuses and minuses depending on if you're going against a practitioner of the same college or of an opposing college. In any case, if you want to be a magic user, you choose this college, and that gives you a smattering of starting out spells, and away you go. Just a brief word on how things work. When you're working in combat, or you're working in spells, or you're working in a skill, you're building up a rank in a weapon, or a spell, or in a skill. And you do that by expending your experience points. So let me talk about each of those things in turn, the combat spells and skills. Combat is very simple. You have a base chance to hit, which is based on your manual dexterity and whatever weapon you're using and the rank that you have with that weapon. You roll some percentile dice, and if the value is less than that chance to hit, then you hit. Now, that chance can be modified by the opposing player or the situation. So if the opposing player has a high agility, or they have a shield, or you're flanking them, then that can modify your chance to hit right there. If you do hit, then you roll a die, and that die is modified by some weapon bonus, either plus or minus, depending on the weapon, and then that is modified by an armor bonus for the other player, so the armor will absorb the damage. Remember how I said that armor should absorb damage? That's how this system works. And that gives you your total damage that you do. So it's very simple. There are very few charts that you need for this. I went through looking through the old school D&D, and I was like, oh my god, I'd forgotten how many charts there were. It's like, oh look, there's a cleric chart, and there's a fighter chart, and there's a thief chart. Like, wow. And none of it is terribly intuitive. With this system, it's pretty much all down on paper, other than any sort of modifiers that apply to the situation, which can all pretty much fit on one sheet. Now, there is a hex-based movement system. If those of you are familiar with the D20 system, there are some similarities here. It's possible that some of this got rolled into D20. I'm not entirely sure. The tactical movement rate controls how many hexes you can move per round. And then there's a certain number of actions you can do depending on what situation you're in. You can either be engaged, which is you're in melee combat. You can be in close combat, which is basically you're wrestling around with somebody, or you can be non-engaged, which is you're stepping back from the action. And non-engaged things are, you know, you run in and become engaged, you can charge, You can cast a spell, of course. You can fire your ranged weapon. And then melee stuff is just the basic stuff like attack. You can evade. You can pass, which is kind of doing a generic action. Like, think of the 5-foot step, for example, in D20. You know, you're pulling out another weapon or you're lighting a torch if you want to do that during melee or things like that. Of course, you can cast a spell. One of the interesting things that I like about this system is you can do what's called a withdrawal. You can basically try to get out of melee combat by doing this withdrawal. This does mean that your opponent gets a free shot at you, but you have a choice of two possible actions when you withdraw. You can either do an offensive withdrawal, which means that you attack. Now you get a minus 20 on your attack because you're backing up while you're doing it, but it does mean you get sort of a free attack as you're backing out of the situation. Or you can do a defensive withdrawal and raise your shield and back out of the way, which gives you a bonus to your defense. So that allows you to disengage from melee. Now, one thing I didn't mention about weapons is that you don't actually train in classes of weapons like you would in D&D 3rd edition. So, for example, in D&D you might study swords. Well, in this one you would study a particular sword. So my character would use the Bastard Sword. I can only assume that because I was a high school student, I liked the name. I think, but the stats were also pretty good as well. Now, this does mean that even though you might have rank in a longsword, for example, this doesn't mean you can pick up a short sword and get some bonuses. You're just treated as if you have no rank in it at all. I'm not sure I quite agree with that aspect of the system, because obviously if I know how to use a sword, I should be able to use, at least with some facility, other swords, even though they are different sizes. But that's the way the system works. So that's combat. Now, as far as magic, I mentioned there are 12 colleges of magic, and these each restrict which spells you can cast. I did mention that there were restrictions on when you can use your spells. Like the elemental colleges, you can only use magic when you're touching an item of that element. So, for example, if you do water magic, you have to have some water nearby, or earth magic, you need to have some, you know, some dirt or something like that. Within each college, there's two different kinds of spells. There's general spells and there's special knowledge spells. The general spells you get for free. You just join the college and you know these spells. Now, you don't have any rank in them necessarily, but at least you can use them. To learn special knowledge spells, you actually have to train and spend experience, and then you can actually get them. There is a limitation on how many spells you can know total, which is based on your magical aptitude. So if you have a low magical aptitude, you can't actually know all the possible spells in your college. And that kind of gives a restriction on creating the sort of tank mage. So you can't put all of your points into the physical stuff, have a low magical aptitude, and hope to be a reasonably effective magic user. You cast a spell by preparing it. There are some restrictions there. You can't be touching cold iron, so you can't have, for example, iron or steel armor on, or be holding a iron or steel sword. Now, there's a way around that. You can use bronze equipment instead, but it wears out faster. You also have to be able to concentrate, which is similar to the D&D system. You just do a willpower check if someone tries to break your concentration. You need to spend some fatigue points when you actually cast the spell, and the number of points you spend depends on whether it's a general or a special knowledge spell. It's either one or two. Then you figure out what the base chance it is to succeed. And that base chance depends on the general base chance of the spell, with some bonuses depending on your magical aptitude, and bonuses for the rank you have in that spell. Now, if your magical aptitude is below 15, you're actually going to get minuses. So there, again, is another restriction. If your magical aptitude is low, you're just not going to succeed in rolling for these things. You also can get a bonus if you spend more time preparing the spell, which doesn't really work in combat, but could work outside of combat. You know, if you want to spend a day preparing and concentrating so you actually succeed at the demon and summoning ritual, which you probably want to do, because if you don't, bad things will happen. And, like combat, you just roll a D100. If it's less than that, then you succeed and all goes well, the spell gets cast. The big problem is if you roll above. If you roll of 30% above during combat or 40% above just during normal everyday stuff, then the spell can backfire. That's a very bad thing, because what happens is it'll do bad things to you. It's equivalent to the critical fumble from, I guess it's D&D 2. Sort of things that can happen. You can go crazy. You can go unconscious. You can lose fatigue points. Well, the last one's not so bad compared to going crazy. I think you can lose the use of limbs and things like that. In general, you don't really want to be casting magic unless you have a high magical aptitude or a high rank in that particular spell. And that provides another limiting factor to the tank mage phenomenon. Another thing that holds back on the tank mage thing is that you can try to block the effect of a spell. So, for example, if someone casts a spell against you, you can use your magical resistance to fight off the effect of the spell. And it's kind of like a saving throw check from D&D. Again, you roll a percentile dice, and if it's less than your modified magical resistance, then you succeed. Now, non-magical people have a higher, at least starting out, higher magical resistance than magical people. They get a plus 20, I believe, to their magical resistance. So again, that's another benefit to being just a straight fighter. You can actually fight off magic easier. Now, I realize that that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense in the whole, well, I'm familiar with magic, I should be able to fight it off better than a non-magical person. I think the only reason it's in there is just as a balancing factor. That gives you a basic sense of the magic system. And then finally, there are skills. And skills are things like, they're actually more like classes, but you're not limited in which ones you can choose. So skills are like assassin or astrologer or military scientist or ranger. And you can choose to be more than one of those things. Or you can decide to just put all your points into one thing. So, for example, if you wanted to be the best troubadour ever, you could put all your experience into troubadour. The skills are kind of the weakest part of the entire system. There aren't a whole lot of skills available, at least compared to the large number of skills available in D&T 3rd edition. And they don't cover such basic things like climbing or swimming, or there are a couple of adventuring skills, one of which is horse mastery, but other than that, they're kind of depending on the GM to create skills for the players to use. And that's actually one of the benefits of going out and looking on the internet for these groups, because people have gone out and created skills to go with the game, which adds a lot to it. That's pretty much everything that is in those first three books. Very, very much summarized. There is, of course, a list of monsters. There has to be a list of monsters. And the monsters range from your standard animals in the wilderness to your standard fantasy creatures like dragons and giants. They're a little more generic than some of the critters that you might find in D&D, and the critters in D&D are pretty generic as well. Oh, I'm sorry, they're also demons as well, but those are discussed in the College of Greater Summoning. But beyond that, I think they're depending on the GM to create new monsters, or perhaps adapt monsters from an existing fantasy role-playing game system, which is the number one fantasy role-playing game system. So if you wanted a gelatinous cube, it should be easy enough to create one, just to take a wild example. Now, as I mentioned a couple times, there is additional material out there. You can go out on the interweb and find all of that. And I'll, of course, have some links to those things. It includes things like the new skills that I mentioned, and a copy of that book, Arcane Wisdom. Now, Arcane Wisdom is sort of the legendary fourth book, and in that, it contains more information about magic and spells. There are some additional colleges in there, like the College of Lesser Summoning, which I guess is for summoning little freets and things like that. I haven't looked at the book in much detail. It also tells you how to create new spells, which can be very helpful for both players and GMs. Other extras out there, there are the usual set of modules that are provided if you want to go out and just run somebody else's dungeon. The setting for Dragon Quest is called the World of Alusia. I can't say I know much about it because we just played it in our own setting. I don't see any need to play in Alusia, but then I don't see any need to play in other fixed settings like Dragonlance either. But if you're interested in pursuing that, that is the setting for Dragon Quest. Okay, so that is the basic game. I realize it went on. I went on for a while, but that is really the game in a nutshell. Looking at it again, now those who remember my Top Secret podcast, remember I was not very flattering to that game. I'm much more flattering to this one. Reading through it, it really does feel like it could fit as a modern role-playing game. Now, it has some flaws in it. The backfire system for magic is a little extreme as a balancing factor for preventing that tank mage situation. But, you know, it's not too bad. If the players are aware of it and they prepare for it accordingly, they can avoid it, and maybe even a GM can probably ignore it if need be. The role-playing situation calls for it. I will say that it's not going to be good for an XP-rich environment, which is generally going to be true for any sort of skill-based system, because what's going to happen is that players are going to spend their XP to build up a character in their own particular way, and then they're just going to run out of things they can spend things on, and they're going to go, all right, well, I guess I'll build up my skill on assassin, or, maybe I'll take up some magic now, or, well, all my stats are at 25, I guess I better go over here. So basically you end up with a very vanilla character after a while. I should say that a lot of these skills have maximums that you can get to, so you can't just keep building up and up and up and up and getting bonuses. There is a cap at a certain point. So I would suspect that if you played the game for a long time and at a high, for lack of a better term, well, let's say high experience character, you'd just pretty much run out of things to do, and you would have to wait for the GM to say, all right, look, we're just going to have to expand these and figure out how your character is going to work. Still, I think this is a great system. I think it's good for players who are experienced, who want to have more flexibility in building up their characters. If you have a good GM who doesn't let players get out of hand, tries to make sure that there's a good balance to the party, so again, you don't have all these tank mages, I think it can be a lot of fun. I think that the combat is a little more streamlined than the standard D20 combat. I've played D20 for a number of years, and I still can't remember, all right, in what situation can I take a 5-foot step, and what can I do in this situation? And whereas with this, I looked at it, even after 20 years, I went, oh yeah, I remember this. I know how this works. So it may just be because, you know, it's a system that I played in my youth, but I think it's a little clearer than D20. And as I mentioned, there are still people out there who are playing the system even though D20 is out. Now, that said, I'm not trying to trash on D20 here. It is clear that D20, whether directly influenced by Dragon Quest, made a lot of changes that made Dungeons & Dragons a lot more like Dragon Quest, for which I applaud it. And I think it actually stole some people away from Dragon Quest. Like I said, this was a very, very popular system, even when it was out of print during the 80s and 90s. But once D20 came along, looking around, I don't see a lot of traffic in the news groups or in the mailing lists after the D20 stuff came out, which is kind of sad. I still like this system. Now, as I mentioned, Dragon Quest is out of print, but you can easily get it online on eBay. It's not that expensive. There are some places out there that are selling it, you know, like online stores. You can go there if you want, if you're really, really interested, but their prices seem a little bit inflated to me, so I recommend, if you're interested in fantasy role-playing, go check this one out. It's a favorite of mine, and I hope for some of you it'd be a favorite of yours. And I'll be back with some closing statements right after this.
It's the PAX. The G23 Paxilon Hydrochloride.
It went out on a broad wave, sir. Everyone who wants it has it.
You need to control this damage. Start a discrediting campaign to deal with these.
Sir, we feel you should know. There are other projects.
Get ready.
I would like to introduce myself. I am Gerald, your hostage.
To live at the edge.
What do you mean he's dead?
Just because I ain't a nice person, sugar, doesn't mean we can't deal.
This attack wasn't random. It was selected.
Surviving in the verse has never been harder.
You'll make a fine Alliance officer someday.
For a brown coat like you. After Serenity, the ongoing campaign, the story has a new season.
What do you mean he's dead?
Hey, what do you guys mean? Is he dead?
Is he dead?
He's dead, isn't he? What do you mean by that?
AfterSerenity.com.
So, thank you for listening to my show on Dragon Quest. I apologize again for the popping peas and slightly lowered audio quality. Next time I'll be back with much better audio quality, and hopefully I won't pop my peas at you. If you want to leave some feedback about this episode or any other episode, I've got some new links up there on the left side of the website. So you can send me email there. That's vintagejim@gmail.com. There's also a link which will pop up by a Skype chat window. My name there is JV Square. Or if you have a headset connected to your computer, you can send me a voicemail message via audio. Or if you want, you can just leave some comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net. So, thus concludes yet another magical episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Until next time, remember to keep on playing those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.